Welcome to the program. Shortly upon taking office, one of Barack Obama's first acts as president was to sign the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Let's take a listen.
This is a wonderful day. First of all, it is fitting that the very first bill that I signed, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Restoration Act, that it is upholding one of this nation's founding principles, that we are all created equal, and each deserve a chance to pursue our own version of happiness. Now, Lilly Ledbetter did not set out to be a trailblazer or a household name. She was just a good, hard worker who did her job, and she did it well for nearly 2 decades before discovering that for years she was paid less than her male colleagues for doing the very same work. Over the course of her career, she lost more than $200,000 in salary and even more in pension and Social Security benefits, losses that she still feels today. Now, Lilly could have accepted her lot and moved on. She could have decided that it wasn't worth the hassle and the harassment that would inevitably come with speaking up for what she deserved. But instead, she decided that there was a principle at stake, something worth fighting for. So she set out on a journey that would take more than 10 years, take her all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and lead to this day and this bill, which will help others get the justice that she was denied.
And it is my pleasure to welcome to our program this morning Lilly Ledbetter to talk about her new memoir, Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. Lilly Ledbetter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you here. 1979, you went to work at Goodyear plant in Alabama. You were, as you write about, pretty excited about that job.
Oh, absolutely. I was a supervisor in the production area of the radial tire division, and that was my goal, to achieve that, to be a part of the new radial division that had been built in Gadsden, Alabama in 1976 to an older factory that was originally built in 1929.
And you worked there for almost 20 years.
That's right.
What were the working conditions like during that period? How were you treated during the time you were there?
There was a lot of sexual harassment propositions and different comments. And the early on in the one of the first evaluations that I ever got, my boss said if I would go and meet him at the Ramada Inn, I'd be rated number one. But if I did not, I'd be at the bottom of the list. And it caught me off guard. I had no idea that a major company would be still allowing this to go on. And, I'm fairly new in my job at that time, and I didn't really know what I should do. I could not afford to lose the job. I knew that. I had college tuition bills to pay and a house mortgage and car payments and food to put on the table, so I just merely got up and left his office. And the next day, after thinking about it, I went back and asked him, could I please finish the evaluation? And he said, no, you're at the bottom of the list. It's a done deal. Said, you had your opportunity or something to that effect. And so it followed me then for the rest of my career in that. But I could not, and I don't believe a person can go in and start being speaking up, because you have to sort of prove what you can do and show people, you know, what you're capable of, and then choose your battles very carefully, because they will follow you from then on.
After you were there for a period of time, and after you had proven yourself and the good job that you were doing, at that point, did you ever consider, 10 years into it, ever speaking up about these kinds of issues, about what was going on?
Well, I spoke up in the early 80s. I finally had to file a charge against another man, because he told me that we were on a special assignment together, he and I and one other young man, and our responsibility, we worked closely together. And he finally got down into the base of what his object was, and he said, if you do not go to bed with me, you won't have a job next week. And I couldn't afford to lose my job, so I went to the HR representative for that division and asked for help. I said, I just would like to request to be moved because of this. This man had started to touch my body, and very appropriately, and it was just from the time I got to work to the time I left, it was nothing but sexual language. And the HR manager took it to mean that I was just a troublemaker and a big complainer, and he said, well, we'll do an investigation. Well, everybody knew to take sides with whatever, you know, the HR department decided. So there was nobody that would back me up except one man. He backed me up. He knew for a fact. And he did back me up, but it cost him dearly later, and people saw that. So they just couldn't afford to come out and support you. But then Goodyear said, the HR man did, that this man had 30 years. He was a good employee. And you're not proven, he said. But the investigation that Equal Employment did gave me the right to sue them. And so Goodyear said, what do you want? I said, I want my other job back, and I want to be moved from this individual. And that's what I got. And that's all I ever wanted. All I ever wanted, and what most women, I've never met any woman that ever wanted to have a file a charge or file a lawsuit, because there's not any money in a case like this. It's extremely hard on a person, and it's extremely hard on their families.
Were there other women employees at Goodyear at the time?
We did not work closely together. We, you know, in other words, we could not compare if we had wanted to or talk, because if there was another female manager, she'd be on a different shift, probably in a different department, and we were never, you know, close together.
So there was no sense, you didn't have a sense what was going on with the few other women that were in the company?
No, not really. I had no way of knowing. And two, Goodyear was, they instructed us to never discuss our pay. If we did, we would not have a job. That was everybody. Huh. In all of the 19 years and 10 months I worked, I never heard anyone discuss how much money they made.
Until you got a tip in 1998, an anonymous note that somebody left you.
That's true. I went into work, and in my little inbox, I had this note that showed my base pay and the three men that we four had the exact same job. No different, just a different shift. They had four crews, A, B, C, D, and that was the only difference was our pay. And mine was 40% less than either one of theirs.
And not only was the pay less, but the pay also, the base pay 40% less, but it impacted overtime, pensions, everything else.
And my retirement. See, first-line managers was paid overtime. Time and a half, double, triple, depending on, you know, the circumstances and how we worked. Because if we did not get the overtime pay, we would have come up short compared to our union men and women, because we all were required to work. And many times we worked 7 days, 7 nights a week. A lot of hours. And when my peer was out on the other shift, I worked mine and his too. And he had a heart attack once, and I think I worked something like 2 months straight, 12 hours each night. And that was a lot of money for my family, and we really needed it back then. I mean, we struggled.
Talk a little bit about your reaction when you got this note. You talk about going into to the ladies' room to try and sort of figure out what you needed to do, if anything.
Well, the main thing I was trying to get for myself was some clear thinking and to focus on the shift ahead of me, because I knew I could not afford to leave my job. I couldn't afford to go back home where I would like to have gone at that moment. But I was so devastated, and it was humiliating to know that I had worked so hard and had been shortchanged, and I was also facing retirement in the very near years future. And like you said, it affected my retirement. But the first thing that hit me was my overtime. And then later it hit me, it's my retirement, my 401K, my contributory retirement, and someday my Social Security. And I was just didn't know what I possibly could do, but I put that in my pocket, and I realized shortly that I needed to get on my job or I'd be late, and that's what I did, and I got through the night. The next day, I told my husband, I have to go to Birmingham and file an EEOC charge unless you object, and I can tell you I'll be in it 8 years. He said, what time you want to leave?
What did you know that was going to start by doing this? You knew it was going to take a long time. What else did you have a sense was going to be unleashed by filing that charge?
A lot of retaliation within my work environment because no one would speak to me, no one would talk to me, and if I met someone in the hall, they'd turn and go the other way because they could not and did not want to jeopardize their job.
Did you consider talking to anyone at the plant about it?
Well, I had already tried to talk to my immediate superior and human resource earlier, several months earlier, about where I stood financially in my pay, getting prepared to go into retirement,
mm-hmm.
and how I stood with my peers, my ratio. And I told my immediate superior, my direct supervisor, that I felt that I was being paid much less than my male counterparts. And I had nothing to base that on, but I was trying to get him to tell me how I stood in some way. And I said, if there's anything I can do to increase my monthly pay rate, I need to do that before I retire. And he said, well, my problem was I was listening to too much BS, except he said the words, to my male counterparts. And when I went to HR, I didn't get an answer. And when I had asked my boss several months earlier about how I stood and was rated, he said, I don't know, but I'll check. 2 weeks later, I saw him, and I asked him, and he said, well, I hadn't had time to check. They were putting me off. They were not going to share anything with me. I went straight directly to the Equal Employment Commission.
Once you filed that charge, talk a little bit about the process that it began.
It began an investigation. In fact, I spent probably 3 hours with an interviewer that took all the time in the world to drag out of me all the details of my career at Goodyear. And then they did an investigation, and several months later, I don't remember exactly, but it was like 6 to 8 months later, they called and said, you've got one of the best cases we've ever seen. You may want to consider getting your own attorney, and we'll issue the right to them for you to sue because we're short of help and we're backlogged, and then you probably can get to federal court sooner. Well, I found an attorney, great firm in Birmingham, Alabama, that took my case pro bono because, you see, people like me in middle management, that's another thing that holds us back. We can't afford an attorney or a firm that we have to pay for 8 to 9 years. And that 8 years that I projected in the beginning, it actually took me 9 years to get my final verdict. Well, the lawyer that I got, he started working on my case, and we did not get to federal court until 2003. And we did get a jury trial. Now, I filed the charge in 98. EEOC called, and I got an attorney in 99. We got to federal court in 2003. 2 years later, it went to the 11th District for appeal by Goodyear. And the 11th Circuit nitpicked and said, threw it out. And then my attorneys appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States in Washington, D.C., and my case was heard there November of 2006, and we waited until May 29th of 2007 to get the final verdict.
And the original federal jury award was almost $4 million.
That's true.
And that was after hearing all the evidence in the case.
That's right.
At a jury trial.
They heard the evidence, and it was plain. They knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I had been shortchanged for 19 years and 10 months, and the drastic effect that it had had on my income during those years through the retirement and the base pay, and then on into my retirements as well. And see, there's nothing in the law that when you win a case, you can say, well, let's, you know, adjust my retirements now. It doesn't work that way. So the jury made that sizable award to take care of that.
Goodyear appealed, as you indicated. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, where it was thrown out on a technicality, on a 5-4 decision. Explain what happened.
Well, the technicality, they changed the law. It wasn't really a technicality. Justice Alito said, he wrote the opinion, and he said, my problem, I should have filed my charge the first time I got the first discriminatory paycheck, even though I didn't know it. But that's when I should have filed my charge. And in a lot of people's case, that could mean the first 6 months of employment, because a lot of times that's when discriminatory pay is originally set. Now, that doesn't make sense at all. The law was not intended to be interpreted that way. It was always based on paycheck accrual. If an individual is still getting a check and they find out that they are getting shortchanged, they have 180 days from the time they find out to file that charge from the time they find out and they're still getting a check. Each paycheck starts a new accounting period. That almost $4 million that the lower federal court awarded me, my $3 million dropped to $300,000 because I was only entitled to $300,000. The jury did not know this. They were real upset about it. But that cap was put on by Congress in 1991, and that cap needs to be removed because it would help people get into a situation like I did to recoup some of their lost overtime and their lost retirements. And back pay, you can only go back 2 years. So the judge took the lowest paid male where I worked and calculated my base pay and his, the difference, and gave me $30,000 each year, no overtime pay. It could have been gotten because I had all my Goodyear has the records, I have the records, but no overtime, just the base pay. And this man only had been with Goodyear a little over a year, was in a lower paying job, transferred into this job, and he was already making a little over $600 more per month than I was. So I left the courtroom with a $360,000 award. It's all I had. Had I got that, my law firm would have gotten HIFE, and I had to pay taxes on a lot of it because it was in lieu of wages. But for me, it was never about the money. When I put that note in my pocket, from that minute on, it was about what was right. It was strictly what was right. The law was on my side. The Equal Employment Commission agreed with me. My attorneys, their big firm, agreed with me. And the jury agreed with me. It was about what was right. It was the law, and the system was working for me until we got to the Supreme Court. And those five justices, two of them had just went on the bench, Chief Justice Roberts and Alito. But Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg hit the nail on the head. She said, these people don't understand what it's like in the real world. People don't and can't stand around the water cooler discussing their pay. And even if you knew somebody was making more than you, that doesn't mean that it's based on discrimination. And she said, they don't understand what it's like in the real world. And she challenged Congress. She said, the ball is in your court. It is up to you to change this back to where it should be. And that's what they did.
Talk about the outrage of Justice Ginsburg and the rare situation where she literally read her dissenting opinion aloud in the court.
She did. A reporter from Washington called me in Linda Greenhouse, and she told me, she said, if I could have heard, I wasn't there when that was read, but Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she read every word of her dissent. They said it rung loud and clear in that Supreme Court. And she said it would, she said even her, she said, I'm just a reporter. And it touched me so much. And it has touched me and a lot of other people. One of the headlines in an article said, I struck a nerve around the country. And I did. And it wasn't just me. And the reason this is so popular, it's not just Lilly Ledbetter. It is every working woman in this country and their families.
Talk about the legislation that would ultimately get signed as literally the first bill that Barack Obama signed as president. Talk a little bit about that process and your involvement in it.
That was tremendous. Barack Obama was a senator at the time, and Hillary Rodham Clinton. And in the Senate side, they worked with Senator Ted Kennedy on the Ledbetter bill. And, of course, the bill had come out of the House. Congressman George Miller was the chairman of the Labor and Education Committee at the time, and it came out of his committee in the House. I testified twice in the House and went on to the Senate to testify, and it was picked up and carried, and it was the first bill that was signed by Barack Obama as president. And I was so thrilled that it made another statement, and I have been so honored that it carries my name, because it leaves the history of what happened and how we need to be really working to correct these laws and these bills that are so detrimental to our American way of family life.
Talk a little bit about Grace and Grit and your decision to write about all of this.
Grace and Grit was a project that I talked from the very beginning when the bill was signed, and I started touring the country and actually the world. I've been outside the country. The Italian ministry is in Rome. They invited me to share my story. And I knew that I couldn't keep that pace up for the rest of my life. And it is so important that young people understand where we've been and how far we've come, but yet how much farther we have to go. And I was one of those people who fell in a trap. I thought because I worked for a major corporation that had government contracts, that I was being protected in all of the rights and laws that I was entitled to, because I felt someone in the government would hold their feet to the fire with those government contracts in order that I would be compensated fairly. And I never knew any different. But I encourage young people today, and that's why I wanted Grace and Grit, because I will never be able to make it to all people and see everybody, but I'm hoping that the people I don't meet personally, that they will read Grace and Grit and understand why it is so necessary that they protect themselves and their family and their working careers.
Talk about the conversations that you have today with young women.
The young women, and especially on college campuses, I want them to understand the laws that pertain to them as an employee and a worker. And today, the young people have the computers, the programs, they can research. There's so much material out there that wasn't available to me as a young woman. But they need to know when they apply for a job and when they're interviewed in that locale, what's the going rate for that job and their experience. And to be sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, they start and negotiate and start out at the best possible rate. Because once you start, and if you say you work 25 or 30 years with a company or in a job and you retire, most of your raises, well, all your raises, is usually a percentage of what you're already making. And you can never catch up if you start out behind. And then that affects your retirement, your Social Security, and any other retirement programs you may be invested in.
Lilly Ledbetter, the book is Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. Lilly, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Hey, thank you. It's not a pretty story, but it's a story that people need to hear and need to know and to correct their lives so that they will be more successful and better.
Thank you so much, Lilly Ledbetter.